Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, the 12th of September. We're going to be talking about some striking parallels between the French Revolution and anti-Christian secularism today. We think of our own revolution in the United States as a benign revolution. I guess by and large it was. It was influenced by the Enlightenment, but there was a more virulent, malignant version of revolution near the same time in France, and it was decidedly not only anti-authoritarian, it was anti-Christian, anti-church. There's a lot of historical evidence for this, but things were left undone. Is it being finished today, not only in Western Europe, but perhaps even in America to some degree? Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University, and he's author of a recent column for Touchstone magazine titled The French Connection. Dr. Hitchcock, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks very much. Been a while.
Is the unfinished agenda of the 18th century French Revolution being completed today in Western Europe?
I would say so. I mean, the history of Western Europe in the last 200 years is ups and downs. There were periods when the government was very, very hostile to religion and restricted religious freedom, then they would be back off a bit. What they seem to be doing right now, first of all, they've declared pretty much officially, we don't recognize our Christian roots, or we refuse to recognize our Christian roots. And I think they're making it more and more difficult for people to live fully as Christians. That didn't happen in the United States, as you say, and it didn't happen in Great Britain, which is from which we derive a lot of our ideas. But there are certainly people who would like to see it happen. There are people who talk about the unfinished agenda of the Enlightenment, and why, in a certain sense, they see America as being a little bit retarded because we didn't seem to go in that same direction.
Okay, so give us a history lesson, because we think of, when we hear revolution, we think of American Revolution, and we think about that largely, at least the way we paint the picture, kind of a benign thing. We did not like the oppressive government of Great Britain, but once we were done with that, we kind of settled down, and it was peace, and it was freedom. But the French Revolution did not proceed along those lines. Talk about that, if you would.
Yes, exactly. Well, we had a rather limited objective in our revolution. We wanted to free ourselves from the rule of Great Britain. We achieved that, and then because of the sense of having been oppressed by Great Britain, the Founding Fathers were at some pains to build in liberty into the Constitution. Where religion was concerned, there had been state churches which had been experienced as oppressive. So one of the things the federal government did was to say there would be no state church. There would be, as far as federal government was concerned, there would be complete freedom. In France, the church was so much a part of the establishment, so much close to the monarchy, that it had to be destroyed. And if you were going to destroy the monarchy, you had to destroy the church, too. And they really set about doing it literally. I mean, churches were closed down. Clergy were hunted down, mostly Catholic priests were hunted down, either executed or killed or murdered. The attempt was made to make it impossible to be a Christian in France. That was modified somewhat when Napoleon Bonaparte came to power, and then a little bit later the monarchy was restored. But those issues remain alive in Western Europe in a way they have not in the United States.
Talk about those sectors of the church and the clergy in particular that thought that the best course was to cooperate with the Enlightenment Revolution in France.
Yes, exactly. What were so-called constitutional clergy who took an oath of primary loyalty to the revolution, which was meant to exclude primary loyalty to the church. Some did it for opportunistic reasons. It was a way of surviving, or it was a way of getting ahead. But the more troublesome thing was some did it because they wanted to reform the church. They thought the church needed reform. And, well, here the government's going to help us. You know, we throw in our lot with the French government, and they will force the church to reform in ways which we think it should. Well, in the end, that didn't prove possible. These same people who surrendered their principles and went along with the revolutionary government, they weren't allowed to practice their religion either. And a number of them also ended up on the guillotine because there was going to be no compromise as far as the revolutionary government was concerned.
The French Revolution had its intellectual elite. Who is the intellectual elite of today?
Well, in a broad sense, the 18th century, they spoke of the philosophes, which didn't exactly mean philosopher, would be the equivalent of what we call intellectual. And I would say the most influential today in our world would be what are sometimes called prestige journalists. I mean, it's a very strong thing on university campuses, but the people who have the most direct effect would be the columnists, commentators, editorial writers on New York Times, on some of the major TV networks. You have to throw in some entertainers, too, because we have this very strange situation in our culture in which actors and movie stars and singers and so forth try to put themselves forward as moral and spiritual leaders. So this kind of mixed group of people, taking them all together, would be our equivalent of the philosophes.
What was this notion in the French Revolution of the natural man? I went very closely together with a complete rejection, an explicit rejection of original sin and the corruption of man in any kind of biblical fall. But what was their idea, and how was it related to an idea of natural religion?
Well, as you say, the rejection of original sin, in some respects, I think they saw they did see the issue, which was the Christian doctrine of sin. Why do we need a church? Well, we need a church to follow the gospel. Why do we have to follow the gospel? Well, because we're in need of redemption. So if you deny that, the French Revolution in many respects ended up discrediting itself because it started out with the idea, basically, well, let everybody do what they want, you know, complete freedom, because people are naturally good. And if we get the church out of the way, we get the king out of the way, people will be able to lead good lives. Well, when it turned out that people often behaved highly irresponsibly with their freedom, then the government becomes increasingly tyrannical. That's part of the whole thing, too. And so they discredit, in a certain sense, they discredit the very idea of the natural man, but they sort of still remained officially committed to it.
What was the idea of natural religion that went along with it? Were there favored religions, sans Christianity, in the French Revolution?
They tried to set up a civic religion. You were supposed to believe in a supreme being. They were called deists. There had to be some order in the universe. This was not a matter of divine revelation. It was all based on reason. They tried to have, you know, like the Feast of the Supreme Being or the Feast of Reason. They actually set up liturgies. They had kind of like their sacred books, which would be read. They tried to just, co-opt religion for their own political and philosophical purposes. That didn't work either, for a while, that's what they tried to do. I think we have an analogy in our culture in what's sometimes called, broadly speaking, New Age, or I think the misuse in our culture of spirituality, where you have people, I'm spiritual, but I'm not religious, which, as far as I can see, means I want the benefits of having a religion, whatever comfort that brings. It helps me to see the meaning of life, but I don't want a religion that imposes anything on me. No religion can tell me what to do. The whole purpose of religion is to make me feel fulfilled, and I think we have that same pattern here, which is somewhat analogous to what the French Revolution was trying to do.
I mean, the French Revolution would have elevated happiness, I don't know if they would have said personal happiness, but certainly happiness to the highest goal. And it seems to me that natural religion, whether it's in the 18th century or today, does exactly the same thing. Your thoughts with about a minute before our break.
Yes, I think that's correct. I mean, of course, the whole key point is, what is happiness? And I think the way they understood it and the way the so-called spirituality people do today, it's very subjective. You know, I don't want to feel frustrated. I want to feel like I've got everything I want. I want to feel fulfilled. And of course, we know that the Christian idea of happiness, you have to pick up your cross and follow Christ before you're going to achieve true happiness.
Dr. James Hitchcock is our guest, with us for another 10 minutes on the other side of the break on this Monday afternoon, September the 12th. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. This break is a great time to call, 1-877-623-MY-IE. We're talking about remarkable parallels between the 18th century French Revolution and anti-Christian secularism today, 1-877-623-6943.
Been hearing about Country Bob's all-purpose sauce and how it tastes great on any and everything you may be cooking and serving at your family dinner table. Well, over the years, I've discovered that Country Bob's is much more than that. You see, Country Bob's is that secret ingredient in many of my recipes, whether it be for chili soups or stews or that favorite marinade for the select meat of the day we're grilling. If you're interested in discovering the secret, log on to countrybobs.com and check out their blog, exchange recipes, or buy yourself a Country Bob's cookbook and become part of the Country Bob's family. And remember, it all comes down to the sauce.
Issues Etc. is listener supported. That means we rely on you for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. Please consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for your support.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Hi, this is Kate in Japan, and I'm commenting on the program you had about the Unification Church.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues Etc. around the world.
The most important point is to say, I love your show and thank you for doing what you do. Bye from Japan.
Old theology, new technology, Issues Etc. worldwide. Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. Issues Etc. IssuesETC.org.
Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at IssuesETC.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. IssuesETC.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Monday afternoon, September the 12th. Dr. James Hitchcock of St. Louis University is our guest. He's author of a recent column for Touchstone Magazine titled The French Connection. We're talking about connections between the French Revolution and anti-Christian secularism today. I think it was Archbishop of Denver, Charles Chaput, very recently had some rather blunt words. He spoke at, I think, to a national stage when he talked about lawmakers in the United States who are members of the Roman Catholic Church, who don't seem to have either much concern or perhaps knowledge of what they ought to believe as Roman Catholics and therefore what they ought to be supporting or opposing as lawmakers. I wonder if that's part of the conflict here that we're finding, in particular in the Roman Catholic Church with its lawmakers, but it affects other confessions of faith as well, where the lawmaker calls himself one thing, but it's quite evident in the way that he governs that his religion is an entirely different thing.
Yes, I think that's true. They will sometimes claim, personally, I am opposed to abortion. Personally, I am a devout Christian, but I don't allow that to influence my public policy. To what extent this is political opportunism is one thing, but the more troubling aspect of it is they really believe it. That is, they're kind of schizophrenic. They may be devout or pious in their personal lives, but they've adopted, they've been converted to a kind of an Enlightenment natural religion idea. One of the things that's really frustrating about this is the way those kind of people often talk is you would think that religious believers are sort of a small minority of our population and they shouldn't be allowed to push their ideas on other people. As a matter of fact, it is non-believers who are a very small minority of our population, and somehow they have succeeded in getting their agenda. The problem, you know, the attack on the church in the French Revolution would not have succeeded without the cooperation in various ways of some of the clergy, and the antagonism to Christianity today in the United States could not succeed without the same thing. When, for example, recently Mayor Bloomberg said no clergy, no prayers at the 9/11 commemoration, and he was criticized for this by some religious leaders, but predictably other religious leaders who came out said, oh yes, the mayor's quite right, you know, we don't expect to participate in this. So that's the kind of problem, you know, that we're dealing with.
You have written, and I'm curious about what you mean, you say liberals' true church is the enlightened welfare state that takes responsibility for both the material and spiritual well-being of its citizens. Liberal Christians, whatever their denomination, in fact, hold their primary membership in that church. What do you mean?
Well, the welfare state we can look at in a rather limited way, that's Social Security, medical plans, and that kind of thing, to which liberals are deeply committed. But it's an ever-expanding idea. The state is enlightened. The state will take responsibility. It will help you financially, but it will help you in other ways as well. Sex education is a good example. You know, the state has an obligation to get kids when they're young so they'll grow up with the correct enlightened ideas about sexuality. We can't have any religious element in the public schools because once again, you know, that would have a sort of a distorting effect. And the attitude, in fact, is, look, trust us, trust us. We're the government. We are the enlightened people. We're the philosophes. We have your best interest at heart. And a lot of Christians have kind of fallen in with that. To some extent, you get cases where it's almost like a trade-off. That is to say, well, okay, if you keep increasing the benefits which people get from the government, we'll go along with you on legalized abortion. Another example of what I mean by saying the welfare state is their real church.
You argue that, contrary to popular opinion, the religious right is condemned as intolerant or even fascist, not because it actively seeks to coerce its belief upon other people, but because it simply refuses to ratify the sexual revolution of the 1960s and other agendas like it. Make your argument.
Yes, exactly. It's not what religious right does. It's the fact that it exists. The affirmation of the natural goodness of man by the French Revolution. Certain Christian doctrines, including that of original sin, are regarded as psychologically damaging. People shouldn't believe such things. It's troublesome. People who believe in miracles are said to be dangerous people because they don't believe in science, and our future lies with science. Church agencies that are basically being hounded almost out of existence because they don't sign on to the idea of homosexual marriage. It's the very fact that you exist is what makes you hateful or objectionable to this enlightened community.
Where does the pro-life movement fit into all of this, Dr. Hitchcock?
Well, it's very much in the center of it. I'd say the pro-life movement is the cutting edge of the distinctively Christian, not exclusively Christian, position on basic moral issues. And I think the pro-life movement, while it has not achieved its goal of rolling back the effects of Roe versus Wade, is in one respect one of the most important dimensions of all of this because of the fact it seems to keep getting stronger. It will not go away. It's won some significant victories. It has had the cooperation of very important political figures, whether sincerely or otherwise. You can't dismiss this whole thing then as just a bunch of marginal kooks. They have kept this in the mainstream, the whole idea in the mainstream of American life, and I think that has been a remarkable achievement. It, again, you can't find that, as far as I can see, in Europe. No pro-life movement any comparable ability.
The 18th century French Revolution, of course, had its reign of terror. Do you see something potential such as that as the agenda of the of that revolution, its ideals, continue to survive in our culture today?
Well, we have it in a somewhat mild way in places like Canada and France, where clergy who speak out against homosexuality can be fined and jailed. That has happened. Again, the United States is quite unique in that that's not happening here, but there are people who would like to see it happen. I don't foresee that we're going to see massive carting people off to the guillotine and that sort of thing, but there will be lots of discrimination. Being queried on, for example, what you believe when you're trying to get into a good university, or you're trying to get you're a young doctor and you're trying to get a residency at a hospital. The prestige media, the New York Times, would never think of hiring an Orthodox Christian. They would be horrified if they found out that you were one and you were applying for a job. So you can be restricted and kept in very narrow confines, and I think we are going to see more and more of that if you're outspoken. One thing that I would emphasize here very strongly is this seems remote in the United States because, of course, right now no politician is going to campaign by saying what I want to do crack down on the churches. But I documented some years ago, if you look at some of the professional literature, the law journals and that kind of thing, which most people don't read and don't know anything about, there you have respectable scholars saying quite bluntly, we can't continue to support religious freedom the way it was contained in the Constitution. Religion is just too damaging to the enlightened society, and we've just got to admit that and start cracking down. There are some in the most extreme case would say we got to go in and monitor families. We've got to go into the home and find out what parents are teaching their children, and if necessary, take the kids away from them. You know, so that's on the agenda. It seems very remote, but it's there. It's kind of the way the ideas of the French Revolution might have been, say, in 1750, 40 years or so before the revolution itself.
Dr. James Hitchcock is professor of history at St. Louis University, author of a recent column for Touchstone magazine titled The French Connection. Dr. Hitchcock, thank you very much for being our guest.
Okay, thank you. Enjoyed it.
If you go to our website tonight, there's something new there for your perusal. Issuesetc.org, click support. Right there in the middle of the support page, you will find a new Issues Etc. YouTube video produced by Pastor David Gallison. Thanks very much to him. It's called Believe. It's about 90 seconds long. It kind of emphasizes the apologetic task that is taken up on a regular basis, on a weekly basis, here on Issues Etc. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and watch the new Issues Etc. YouTube video called Believe. You can also find it at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Well, they say the price is vigilance. The price of liberty is constant vigilance. And that means even in the name of liberty, sometimes liberties can be taken away from us. Religious liberty, of course, is paramount. It is really the crown jewel of all the liberties that are afforded to us in our culture, one that we do well to defend not only for our own sake, but for our neighbor's sake as well. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.